From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell preparing for tomorrow's historic House vote on whether to impeach President Trump.
I'm sure he's going to be very angry at how I vote, so I suppose I'm telling you how I'm going to vote.
Michigan's big stories of the past decade, including water, Flint's water crisis, PFAS contamination, and...
There was the dioxane plume in Ann Arbor. There's dioxin, PCBs, PBBs, mercury, algae blooms. Remember the cyanobacteria? Water withdrawals by Nestle. And, of course, Line 5 has been a huge controversy.
Plus, a Democratic congressman and the Republican who was co-speaker of Michigan's House on the quest for bipartisanship.
Talking about compromise is more difficult these days than it was 18, 20 years ago.
It really is.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we will review the stories that shaped Michigan over these past 10 years, from Flint water to Larry Nassar to the Detroit bankruptcy, and so much more. But first, today the House of Representatives is setting rules for tomorrow's historic impeachment vote when Donald Trump is expected to become the third president in history to be impeached. Right now, members of the House are deciding how they'll vote. No Republicans are expected to vote to impeach. One Democratic rep switched parties to back up his no vote. And House Republicans are lobbying undecided Dems to vote no. One of the Democrats in the eye of this hurricane is the congresswoman from Michigan's 12th District, Debbie Dingell. Welcome back to the program, Congresswoman.
It is wonderful to be with you, Cindy.
So have you decided how you're going to vote tomorrow?
You know, I am leaning towards how I'm going to vote, but I think this is a very sad time for our country. I don't think any of us comes to Congress with the desire to impeach the president of the United States. And I'm really worried about how divided this country is. But I also know that no one's above the rule of the law, and that when I take an oath of office, it's not to put my finger in the air and the score of the politics. It's to protect our Constitution and our democracy.
We are here a day before the vote. What more do you need to see or need to think about in order to make your decision? What's the calculus here in your timing?
Well, I probably have made the decision, but I just keep rereading the Intelligence Committee report. The president denying people or saying to people, you cannot go testify before these committees. They're a clear obstruction of the Congress. I've gone back and read the Constitution. Believe it or not, I've read it like four or five times. But the clear, equal three branches of government, the oversight responsibilities we've had. I've read the Federalist Papers. I've read constitutional scholars. I went back and read all of the documents related to the Nixon Watergate investigation. I went back and read Clinton investigations because I am worried. I don't think that the country was as divided when the Nixon impeachment occurred or the Clinton impeachment occurred or the votes, the issues around them. But the fact of the matter is that nobody is above the rule of the law. And it is a clear violation of someone to ask a foreign government to support a political campaign. Has this risen to that level? And I do believe that this White House has very clearly tried to obstruct Congress and just being able to talk to people that need to be talked to and to get the facts.
I'm certainly hearing between the lines of what you're saying and what you're weighing. I guess I'm wondering why the reluctance to say, yes, it's going to be this way or yes, it's going to be that way.
You know, because I want people to know that it's a transparent process, that it's not a political vote. It's a conscious vote. It's a moral vote. It's about protecting this country. I take it so seriously. I didn't want to be part of drama, although the president sort of drew me into it. I've been very clear and very measured from the beginning about my concerns about division in this country. Russia, if you read the Mueller report, which is not brought into these impeachment charges, saying that Russia's trying to divide this country, reading intelligence reports of other countries about how Russia's trying to destabilize our government, that's also part of my job, protecting our national security. But more important is the fact that nobody is above the rule of the law. The rule of the law is what brings us together. So I've wanted thoughtful discussions because I think this is a sad day for our country, and it requires and demands thoughtful conversation and decisions.
Congressman, what are you hearing from your constituents in your district, especially those who believe it's the voters who should have their say on Donald Trump's future next November at the ballot box, not an impeachment?
You know, I've heard from many people. I had to go yesterday for an asthma checkup at the University of Michigan, and this has never happened to me before. But I think 25 people stopped me in and out the way to and from. And the last woman I saw was embarrassed to stop me. She said, "You're at a hospital. I shouldn't be bothering you." But she was against impeachment, and she said it in a very calm way. I've had people scream at me that I haven't been a leader. You know, we need to get rid of him. And I'm very clear that the manner in which this has to be handled is very, very serious. And you don't go out and organize these major rallies that stir up hate and divide us further as a country. And I've had a lot of people scream at me. Quite frankly, the president's tweet on Saturday brought out some very angry, not nice people. And that bothered me too. But I also, on the way back to Washington last night, a man came up to me in the airport. I've never met him before, hugged me and said, "You're my congressperson. And I thank you for just being the person that you are and being so thoughtful." Hmm. So there are a lot of different approaches and how people think. People are engaged. I can tell you that much. And there are a lot of strong emotional feelings.
When I saw you on the receiving end of that Trump tweet over the weekend, where he basically complained you had thanked him for granting top memorial and funeral service honors for your husband, John, and then now, as he said, "I watch her ripping me as part of the Democrats' impeachment hoax." What were your feelings when that tweet hit?
First of all, I have been very careful to not rip anybody apart. I believe that people need to be respectful. And I have been measured in everything that I have said. And quite frankly, I felt like I had been kicked in the stomach. And it's really bothered me over the weekend. John Dingell earned those honors. He fought in World War II. He was proud to be an American. He can go after me. I'm sure he's going to be very angry at how I vote. So I suppose I'm telling you how I'm going to vote. But I just don't want to be part of the drama. But to tarnish the service of my husband, it really made me sad. And honestly, Cindy, I'm already having a hard time at this holiday. So It was hard. To say that it didn't bother me would be a lie.
And I want to make sure I'm very clear. You said, "I don't think President Trump's going to like the way you vote tomorrow."
You are correct.
Well, you did respond on Twitter. And please share with us what your message was back to President Trump.
I've been clear since the day he won that I would work with him if the issues would help the working men and women of my district. People are worried about lowering prescription drugs. We have a new NAFTA trade agreement that we're all looking at. There are many issues that we do need to worry about and deliver for the people of this country that we're working on every single day. But that doesn't mean I abdicate my responsibility to protect this country, our national security, or our democracy. And that's the oath of office that I take.
You know, I think about the fact that your husband was there for the Nixon impeachment hearings and the Nixon resignation. He was there for President Clinton's impeachment. Are you talking to John as you make this decision?
I keep saying, "I wish you were here. I wish I had your advice." I think about him. I've gone back and read his book again, by the way, just to, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, so many people think that this is, we just have to get rid of him. Well, I will not be voting for him in the next election, and I'm going to work very hard to get someone who's going to unite us as a country and vote the way that I do on many issues. It's just, this is a very hard time in this country, and I'm really worried about this division. I worry about what social media has done to us and the way that people can just say the most bullying, vitriolic things. I think the worst thing this president has done is that the tone of the rhetoric in this country and the way that people talk to each other and the things that people say are okay to say to each other is devastating. People can disagree agreeably. And I think we need to get back to those kinds of days where people actually talk to each other. God gave us two ears and one mouth for a reason. People have different life experiences, different perspectives. We learn from each other. When you bring those learnings together and find common ground, you actually get to good places.
You know, here we see Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell not budging. We haven't seen anybody make movement, and we can, I'm sure, expect as much as the House is going to impeach, the Senate will not remove him from office. Where do we go from here, Congresswoman?
Well, I mean, first of all, I will say that I was working for Senator Bob Griffin, a Republican senator, when I was very young. I remember flying back with him from Michigan the day that he called Richard Nixon and told him he needed to resign. And he talked to me about what his responsibility was first to this country. The fact of the matter is that there are people that should have testified before the House that I hope the Senate will call, the chief of staff at the White House, the former national security advisor. We don't know what further facts will come. So in essence, the vote we do is a prosecutor bringing charges, but the Senate will consider all the facts. So we need to be working for the people. I was with Senator Stabenow and my colleagues just a short period of time ago. There are 400 bills that we have passed in the House that the Senate has yet to take up. 90% of them are bipartisan. They don't send us to Washington to fight. They send us to Washington to work for them, to protect them, to deliver, to make their lives better. And we got to figure out how we're going to do that. Many of my friends on the Republican side, I talked to them. I worked with this president, and that's maybe why the tweet bothered me, because we in the Congress have to work with each other across the aisle and recognize the danger that the division in this country is to our democracy.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, we want to thank you for talking with us through the years on Stateside, including today at this moment in American history.
Thank you. I'm going to miss you. I have to say that. You have been a rock in my life before Congress, during my Congress, and you just better stay in touch with all of us because we love you. You've done so much for the Southeastern Michigan community, and you're a voice of reason, knowledge, and steadiness. We love you. We will miss you.
Well, thank you so very much. And I will be following our public leaders as you do this tough job, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Michigan Radio will, of course, be carrying NPR's live coverage of tomorrow's House impeachment vote. We will be reviewing the top stories that shaped Michigan over the past decade.
We led the way into the recession, but we also led the way out of it for several years there. And the Michigan unemployment rate was below the national average through the first half of this decade.
That is next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Two weeks from tonight is New Year's Eve. Goodbye, 2010s, and hello, 2020s. The end of a decade. Life in Michigan on the cusp of 2020 is quite a bit different than what it looked like in 2010. So let's reflect on the stories that most shaped Michigan over these 10 years. And to do that, we welcome Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer. So Dustin, let's start with something that our state is really noted for, which is water.
Yeah, water is always a big issue in Michigan. And that was definitely true in the 2010s. I mean, I think when I started to reflect back on some of the biggest stories our newsroom covered, some of the biggest things that shaped Michigan in the 2010s, the first thing that came to mind for me was the Flint water crisis. And I think that's true for a lot of us. And you can trace it back to April 25th, 2014. Our reporter Steve Carmody was covering this. That's when the switch was flipped to take Flint off of Detroit water and switch it to the Flint River. And a lot of the problems, all of the fallout came from that moment. And as we know, it became just a huge, massive global cautionary tale.
In fact, yeah, it got attention all around the world, early on in the outside attention. I mean, we got Cher on Stateside to weigh in on it.
These children that are drinking this water, it will last in their systems and their cells forever. I mean, that, you can't just stand by.
And Flint wasn't the only water disaster Michigan faced in the teens, was it?
No, I mean, there was just all kinds of stuff. I mean, remember the Kalamazoo River oil spill with Enbridge? That happened in 2010. PFAS pollution, which has been around for a long time, it really wasn't discovered until the 2010s. It was a state geologist who wrote the first report in 2012. It took years for that report to really get out to the public. There were the water shutoffs in Detroit. The ACLU called it the largest residential water shutoff in U.S. history. There are still thousands of people in Detroit who have been shut off from water. There was the dioxane plume in Ann Arbor. There's dioxin, PCBs, PBBs, mercury, algae blooms. Remember the cyanobacteria, water withdrawals by Nestle. And of course, Line 5 was a huge, has been a huge controversy, is an ongoing huge controversy because it's in one of the most vulnerable sections of the Great Lakes. And even the problem with lead in the water has continued since Flint. And the state has revamped how it tests for lead in water. And because of that, 20 more communities have had lead above the federal action level. That's 20 communities with high levels of lead in the water, many of them with higher lead levels than even Flint.
It is amazing. And I have no doubt that there'll be a lot of coverage in the 2020s on this issue.
It will continue to be an issue. Yep.
Absolutely. So next up, Michigan's economy down and up.
Shock and panic evident on the faces of those on the trading floor.
We're in the midst of a serious financial crisis.
For Wall Street, it was another case of whiplash. The markets haven't been this volatile in almost 80 years.
Michigan has been experiencing a one-state recession. Now the rest of the country is getting a sour taste of what the state has been feeding on for a couple of years now.
Boy, that was something. So kind of walk us through the ups and downs, Dustin.
I mean, it was bad. I mean, you remember what it was like. Everyone who was here at the time remembers. And as a reporter, it was like every day there was a new plant closing. There was an office closing. There were layoffs all the time. And it was all you really heard about. People were looking for jobs. People were losing their homes. I mean, 1 in 8 people at the start of this decade was looking for work in Michigan. Michigan was leading the nation in foreclosures. There were just empty houses. We were losing people left and right. We lost more than 170,000 residents between 2004 and 2010. It was really, really bad. But I don't think anyone could have predicted or would have predicted just how much Michigan has roared back. We led the way into the recession, but we also led the way out of it for several years there. And the Michigan unemployment rate was below the national average through the first half of this decade. And now it seems like it's leveling off. We're in sort of a period here where we're not quite sure where it's going, but absolutely the economic recovery of Michigan is one of the biggest things that happened here in the 2010s.
There's a corollary to the tough economic years, Dustin Dwyer, and that is the story of emergency managers in Michigan.
Yeah, and of course, Michigan has had an emergency manager law on the books for a long time, but it was in the 2010s when it really started to have to use these emergency managers because of the economy. So many cities, so many school districts were having these financial troubles, and the state just took them over and installed these emergency managers. The list is Detroit, Flint, Pontiac, Hamtramck, Allen Park, Benton Harbor, Ecorse, Three Oaks, Detroit Public Schools, Muskegon Heights Public Schools, Highland Park Schools. All of them were under the control of an emergency manager at some point during the 2010s. And it wasn't until 2018, when Highland Park Schools were removed from an emergency manager's oversight, that for the first time in 18 years, no municipal, no city, no town, no village, no school district in Michigan was under the control of an emergency manager.
Well, from that, we have to dovetail into a story that truly made U.S. history when Detroit was plunged into bankruptcy and the history books becoming the largest municipal bankruptcy in United States history.
Yeah, so July 18th, 2013 is when the official filing happened, but as anyone who's followed Detroit knew that it was coming for a long time, and of course Detroit was under the control of an emergency manager when it made that filing. The city faced $18 billion in debt and a really uncertain future, and as you remember and as a lot of people remember, one of the biggest questions, one of the knottiest issues they had to work out is how can they resolve that debt and save some of the city's most valuable assets, particularly the Detroit Institute of Arts. Remember, there was a big fear that the DIA would just have to go away. They would have to sell off that amazing collection so that Detroit's retirees could have health care. And it took a lot of work to get that settled. They called it the grand bargain for months and months there. Our reporter Sarah Swick was following it. I know you were following it on Stateside very closely as the twists and turns happened. And eventually, the grand bargain worked. They assembled philanthropists, they assembled the state, they had private funds, public funds, they put together almost $900 million. And they saved the DIA. They came up with a deal that Detroit retirees could live with, although it has been tough, as our own Sarah Swick has reported. And Detroit emerged from bankruptcy.
It's an amazing story to have been on the, you know, to been part of covering that. Agreed. We're going to switch gears now to a story that is still reverberating, not just in Michigan, but nationally and internationally, and that is Larry Nassar. Remind us, when did the reckoning begin, Dustin?
Well, one moment that I think really changed things was on January 16th, 2018. The stories had become public at this point. Larry Nassar had been found guilty at this point. And it had been a story that we were covering closely in Michigan. Our own Kate Wells was there for the entire trial, and there were a lot of stories. But on that January day, Kate Wells retells this story in their podcast, Believe, that she hosted with Lindsay Smith, of Kyle Stevens, who got up to speak and give a witness statement during the sentencing of Larry Nassar.
I've been coming for you for a long time. I've told counselors your name in hopes that they would report you. I have reported you to Child Protective Services twice. I gave a testament to get your medical license revoked. You were first arrested on my charges. And now, as the only non-medical victim to come forward, I testified to let the world know that you are a repulsive liar and that those treatments were pathetically veiled sexual abuse. Perhaps you have figured it out by now, but little girls don't stay little forever. They grow into strong women that return to destroy your world.
You know, I'm hearing those words and I have tears in my eyes. Those Nassar survivors, that sisterhood of those survivors, and we could hear it with Kyle. That was life-altering.
Well, and as what Kate Wells said in her reporting was, it was that moment when Kyle Stevens stepped forward that many more survivors of Larry Nassar's abuse decided to step forward. At first, it wasn't clear how many people would speak. And then you remember, after that moment in that trial, hundreds of people came forward. More than 200 people spoke at that trial about his abuse, and he will serve the rest of his life behind bars.
It's a good time to remind everyone that if you have not yet, you need to hear all 8 episodes of the podcast Believed, hosted by Kate Wells and Lindsay Smith. It's just incredible reporting on a story that will rip your soul apart. I'm speaking with Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer as we review the stories that most shaped Michigan in the 2010s. And next up, police community relations.
So this was a story that was happening nationwide. I mean, the 2010s, Black Lives Matter movement really got started and really shaped a lot of things in America. But it's worth remembering that all these things played out locally here in Michigan as well, really from the start of the decade. 2010 was the year that Ayanna Stanley Jones was shot by a Detroit police officer and killed. He claimed it was an accident. There were 2 trials over this case. In both trials, there was a hung jury. But it really awakened people, I think, even before the Black Lives Matter movement, to police in their communities and what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable and how to hold police accountable when things like this happen. And that continued to be an issue in communities across Michigan and across the country for the entire decade. This year, just this year, the city of Detroit paid an $8.25 million settlement to the family of Ayanna Stanley Jones. There were other cases. You know, I live in Grand Rapids. The story of community and police relations has dominated in Grand Rapids all this time, and there was a series of videos of Grand Rapids police either arresting or pointing their weapons at children, unarmed people. That led to all kinds of reforms. There's a new police chief in Grand Rapids. There were tons of meetings. Still, a lot of people in Grand Rapids don't trust the police. So there's a lot of work left to be done in this area, but it's certainly something that shaped a lot of Michigan communities for the last 10 years.
And our next story happened in that burst of fevered bill passing that happened during lame duck in December 2012 when Michigan became a right-to-work state. What a moment in our state's history with those huge protests outside the Capitol in Lansing.
Hey, I mean, almost unthinkable. If you were coming into the decade in the 2010s, you would have thought, no way is Michigan going to become a right-to-work state. This is a union state, right? But it happened, and it happened after Wisconsin and Indiana had some fights, and they were both sort of, they were very contentious, especially in Wisconsin. And at the start of 2012, remember, Rick Snyder, the governor at the time, was asked about whether Michigan should become a right-to-work state, and he said it was too divisive. We shouldn't pursue it. But Republicans did pursue it. Republicans in the state legislature did pursue it. And it led to all kinds of controversy in Lansing.
We're almost out of time. I know there was other stories on your list. Certainly when legal weed, recreational weed is a very big moment. Also the flooding because of climate change, another big story. And then as we peer ahead to the presidential election coming up in November 2020, here we are talking about the fact that, on the eve of when President Trump's bringing his Merry Christmas tour to Michigan with a campaign stop in Battle Creek, Michigan became a swing state.
Yeah. Another thing that would have been unthinkable, at least to Democrats in 2010, is that Michigan went for a Republican presidential candidate. I mean, even in 2012, Michigan didn't go for a Republican. And that Republican was born in Michigan, Mitt Romney.
Right.
But Donald Trump won the state in 2016. And sure enough, he and Mike Pence have both promised they'll be here a lot in 2020.
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer, looking back over the past decade, and I have enjoyed working with you, Dustin Dwyer, and I'll be listening along with everyone else as you plunge into covering what's happening in Michigan in the 2020s. Thank you.
Hey, likewise. And the 2010s at Michigan Radio was certainly shaped by you, and we will miss you a lot, Cindy, so thank you so much.
Thank you, Dustin.
This superb One Direction highway is engineered for easy grades and for speed with safety. The echoes of that two-cylinder motor have never died, and they never will.
Hold the turn signal! You've learned to drive!
Here for our latest installment of Learn to Drive is Lieutenant Mike Shaw of the Michigan State Police. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So, getting stopped on a, you're driving along and suddenly you see the lights flashing and someone like you is pulling me over. We've seen some tragedies nationally on both sides of it, the person stopped and the officer who's doing the stopping. Let's just kind of walk through what to do when that flasher goes on behind to keep everybody safe.
So the first thing that we tell people to do because of what's listed in the law, and we went go all the way back to driver's ed, is, you know, we want you to pull over to the right. Sometimes even on the freeway system, people for some reason would just jump over on that left shoulder. Go ahead and pull it to the right. Yeah, we're going to wait for you. If you want to get off the freeway, turn on your turn signal, and you can take me all the way up to the exit and go all the way up there. As long as you're not doing 100, you know.
Trying to evade you.
Right. You know, yeah. if you slow down, turn on your hazards, go up there, we'll follow you to a safe spot. Because most of the time, if you're in an unsafe spot, we're going to tell you on the PA system or something like that to continue on or move over or do something. So we want you to be in a safe spot, and I want me to be in a safe spot as well. So that's the first thing we're going to do. The second thing is if it's dark out, go ahead and turn on your interior lights. That helps out quite a bit. It helps out for you if you're looking for documentation, and it helps out for me so I can see inside the car. And you have to understand that when we approach that car, we don't know who you are. We don't know if you're the law-abiding citizen. We don't know if you have just murdered somebody. So we have to kind of be cautious as we kind of walk up there. And that's where a lot of the confusion comes up there. Have somebody get in a car sometime, sit in the passenger seat, and just walk up to the side and have them just move around a little bit and kind of imagine that you don't know who they are or what they're doing. So we recommend that you go ahead and put your hands on the steering wheel. And when the officer comes up there, I can only tell you about MSP and what our official orders say, but we're supposed to identify ourselves of who we are and why we stopped you. And that's usually the first thing that's going to come out of my mouth is, good morning, good evening. I'm First Lieutenant Mike Shaw. The reason I stopped you today is because you are an aggressive driver and you've been tailgating people. You've not used your turn signal. You're driving over, whatever it is. Can I see your driver's license, please? And then that's when I want you to actually start to look for your driver's license. If you're a CPL holder, that's the time that you need to tell me that you have a weapon inside the car. even if you don't have a weapon and you're a CPL holder, you should tell me that I'm a CPL holder, I do not have my weapon with me. And that's going to avoid a lot of that type of confrontation that's kind of go back for. We're not saying that, you know, CPLs are good. We're not saying they're bad. We're just saying that if you have a gun in the car legally, I need to know about it, you know. And then usually from that point on, registrations now and everything, you can finally get onto your phone. So I may ask you for that. Do you have that on your phone? Do you have paperwork? Let me see what it is. I'm going to go back to the car, check out whatever it is. You're either going to get a ticket or you're not. And then I'm going to walk back up there and we're going to discuss that process. And that's pretty much pretty simple of what it is. Usually the biggest mistake that drivers make a lot of the times is they'll start searching for stuff, or they'll whip off their seatbelt, or they'll freak out about stuff, you know. And if you're nervous, I'm nervous, because it kind of transmits back and forth between the two, you know, and I get it. I mean, I've been a police officer. I did 11 years in the Army as a military police officer. I've been almost 25 years in May as a state trooper. I get nervous when the police pull me over. So I get it. I understand exactly what happens in that process, because we never want to be in that position. But, you know, if you're cool to us, basically, is what I always tell people, we'll be cool to you right back. And that's usually how it is. We treat people the way that we want to be treated. And you should probably treat that officer the same way that you would want to be treated in that situation.
Lieutenant Mike Shaw, Michigan State Police, thank you so much.
Thank you.
After the break, we talk with Congressman Dan Kildee and former Speaker of Michigan's House Paul Hilligans about the paths they took into politics and the quest for bipartisanship in a divided country.
Talking about compromise is more difficult these days than it was 18, 20 years ago.
It really is.
That is next here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, after 40 years on radio and TV in Michigan, I am retiring. My final show is right around the corner. Over the years, I have interviewed thousands of people, and there are some that I just really, really enjoy and really look forward to interviewing. And I find myself wishing I would love to get these folks together and just talk, maybe get to know them a little better, the way you get talking at a good dinner party. So two people on my favorite guest list are here with me today. Very familiar faces in politics, both in Michigan and in Congress. Dan Kildee of Flint is the Democratic congressman from Michigan's 5th District, first elected in 2012, right when we launched Stateside. He is now the chief deputy whip of the House of Representatives. Paul Hilligans is a West Michigan Republican. He served in the Michigan House of Representatives from 1979 until 1996. He was part of a very unique moment in Michigan history when he served as co-speaker of the House along with the late Democrat Curtis Hertel Sr. He's been president of Detroit Renaissance, director of government relations for DTE Energy, director of the Regional Transit Authority of Southeast Michigan. He's with the Michigan Health Endowment Fund. And thanks to both of you for coming to my dream dinner party.
Thank you.
I know we could pretend we're drinking wine even as we drink our bottled water. But yeah, I am forever fascinated by the paths that we take that can lead us places that perhaps we didn't expect to be. When I was in grade school and even high school, I thought I was going to be a physician and or a nun, or perhaps both. Clearly, that didn't happen. Paul, when you were growing up in Holland, did you see yourself in a life of public service?
I didn't, although I was steered that way by my dad, who was a pastor, a chaplain at Hope College, and very engaged in social justice issues, and made me very aware of the issues of the day. But I recently pulled out an old vocational booklet that I wrote for a citizenship class, and I was going to be a teacher, a psychologist, or a pastor.
Well, there you go. And I know you were actually, Dan, were the, am I right? You ran for office at a rather tender age?
Yes, I was 18 years old.
And I read that you were at that time one of the youngest people in the country elected to office.
I was. This was 1977, you know, in the early 1970s when 18-year-olds were given the right to vote. There was a bit of a rush of very young people running for public office, and many, many for boards of education. I mean, obviously, in some ways, the only, maybe most relevant role that a very young person could have. And so I had sort of grown up in a political family, was, you know, enamored of politics as a kid, grew up sort of observing the 60s as a very young person, mm-hmm. and felt like I didn't want to wait. And, you know, I got elected to the school board when I was really, really young. I'm really glad it was the pre-digital era, because the pictures wouldn't be so good.
It wouldn't be so good. You know, when you think about what it takes to be elected, to be a politician, so you're out, you are putting yourself out there, you are knocking on doors, you are making yourself available to people. Did that come easily at first to you when you decided to run for office?
It did not. I've always been a bit of an introvert, so I've wondered, how did I get involved in politics? But my interest really developed when I was a student at the University of Michigan during the 60s. I was a protester. I like to tell my Republican friends the first national convention I attended was as a protester in Chicago in 68.
There's some history.
But the life-changing experience for me was being an intern at the University of Michigan's Washington internship program. And I worked for Congressman Marvin Esch and then ended up with a job with Congressman Phil Rupee, both moderate Republicans, mm-hmm. Who shaped my interest in politics in a very moderate way and encouraged me to think about running one day. And so it was really that desire to serve in the end, more than wanting to knock on doors. But I did it.
That was the price you had to pay to be able to serve. How about you, Dan? I mean, and you were young as you were campaigning initially.
Yeah, I mean, I was really young, almost too young to know any better in a lot of ways. I don't know if I had been a little bit older if I'd have made the choice to run for public office. But I was.
Why is that?
Well, because, you know, it's not all it's cracked up to be. I mean, it's not. It looks glamorous, I know, from the outside, and particularly in the job, you know, that I have right now, being members of Congress. People think, you know, it's lunch at the Palm, and you know, everything is really wonderful. We can't complain about these jobs, but it's a really tough life. It's not one that I would choose for one of my kids. And like Paul, I'm not naturally outgoing. People think we are because we have to develop the skill to be able to communicate and to speak publicly and to communicate ideas effectively. But many people that I know, myself included, in public office were generally a little more shy, a little more reserved personally. So I don't think it's a natural role for many people to play. You just have to do it in order to be effective at it, and so you overcome that.
So the greater good of being able to do public service outweighs the awkwardness you might feel knocking on some stranger's door.
Yeah, that part's tough.
The other thing I've always wondered about is what it's like election night waiting as returns come in.
Oh, my gosh.
Look at the face. Look at the face.
It's tough.
What does it feel like?
I mean, I don't know that there's anything that compares to it, but it is there's a lot of anxiety. Even in elections, I don't know if this has been your experience, where everyone else says that the outcome is predetermined. Everyone says, what do you have to worry about? It's in the bag. There's this one guy I know from Saginaw, he says, Dan, it's in the bag. If it's your name on the ballot, you know, you're anxious. You're always anxious because it's not natural to have the public offer a referendum on you as a person. That is a tough thing to go through.
Yeah, what about you, Paul?
I feel the same way. The memories of election night are not always happy memories, even though they might have been election victories. You work so hard during a campaign, and you put so much of yourself into it, and it really does feel like a referendum on you very personally. More than maybe the issues of the day or the political environment. You take it personally.
What were you not prepared for, Paul, once you got to the state capitol, your brand new legislator, and there you are representing your district in Lansing? What surprised you? What weren't you prepared for?
I entered the legislature during one of the downtimes in the Michigan economy, And I wasn't prepared for the conflict between wanting to support, for example, a tax increase to deal with a recession, and a district that was overwhelmingly opposed. That dilemma of, do you need to represent your district, and or should you vote your conscience? And I found that over time, and this is the tragedy of term limits in Michigan, over time, as you get to build trust with your constituency, that decision-making becomes easier because there's more trust in the decision you make, even though constituents may not agree with it. But early on, that was the dilemma I wrestled with a lot.
Oh, boy. And I know, Dan, you took your Uncle Dale's
right.
seat, so you weren't unfamiliar. It was in the family, but there you are. It's your turn. You're the one sitting in that seat.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tough role. I think, I don't know if this was a surprise, but to fully realize the extent to which, in order to get anything done, you have to be willing to disappoint people. Leadership, this is something that I learned later on in life from one of my favorite professors, but that I learned it in real terms. Leadership is the act of disappointing your own supporters at a rate they can absorb. If you want to get something done, if you actually want to advance the ball, you've got to be able to not just get to the front of every parade and pretend you're leading it, but tell your supporters things they don't want to hear. Tell them the hard things. Tell them that we're not going to get everything we want, but in order to make progress, we're going to accept this compromise and we're going to live to fight another day. It would seem that it's always your opposition that you're irritating, but very often the people that you irritate the most are the people who helped get you where you are and now don't want to hear you tell them that they have to accept something less than the perfect solution that you talked about during the campaign.
Because there are no perfect solutions, are there?
No, and I assume that talking about compromise is more difficult these days than it was 18, 20 years ago.
It really is.
If you've just joined us, we're having one of my dream dinner conversations, dinner party conversations, as we speak with Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint and the former co-speaker of the Michigan House and Speaker of the House, Paul Hiligans, who served in the Michigan House from 79 to 96. Getting criticized is part of the job, and you just kind of wonder where we go. In fact, it was interesting. The Detroit Free Press recently had a big, big piece from USA Today's Susan Page digging into a new survey done of American attitudes, and 83% of people say gridlock and divisiveness in politics are a big problem for this country. But a very high percentage of Republicans, Democrats, and independents also believe there is more common ground between us than the media or politicians say. What does that say to you about how we encourage less toxic public debate? What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, that's very true. And I think one of the frustrations that I have is that the impression of gridlock is greater than the reality of it. Now, it is true on the big questions, the sort of divisiveness, red versus blue, does get in the way. But I do have to find some reassurance that on a certain level, there's a lot more collegiality than people know.
Where is that?
Well, I mean,
tell people what would surprise us.
Like, even in Congress, I shouldn't say, it's a terrible way to start, even in Congress, some of my closer friendships are with people who, on a regular basis, I walk over to the floor of the House and we cancel one another's votes out. I'll give you an example, John Molinar. John and I are friends. Like, we would be friends if we weren't in Congress. We chat with one another. We talk about family. We have an annual bet over the congressional baseball game. We don't mind one another's company. And from time to time, we've been able to work together on issues where we actually agree. John, for example, helped me when I needed a Republican ally on the Flint water crisis. John stepped up, and he and I did that work together. Hardly anybody knows that. Unless I talk about it, nobody knows it. And while that is not the predominant sort of dynamic in Washington, it's a reminder that it's possible. And that why is it that we can work together on something that for me was as big an issue as I was ever going to face, Flint? Why can't we translate that to these bigger questions? And I think, you know, it's obviously because there are forces that don't want us to. But on a level, and that's just one example. you know, we're all just human beings trying to do a job. We have much more in common, far more in common than what divides us. But we are reinforced by interests that benefit from us being at one another's throats all the time. Compromise? You get penalized for compromise if you do it too much by party leadership or by other interests. And we have to be willing to kind of work through that, I think.
And your point in history when you shared the speakership with Curtis Hertel Sr. Tell us, I mean, that could that happen today?
I'm not sure it could in the current environment. It's not that we didn't. When the voters saddled us with 55-55 split in the House, it's not that Curtis and I didn't try for a couple of months to find a traitor to give us the majority. When that didn't work, we were forced to sit down together. And maybe that would happen today. What I think would have been hard or would be hard today is to retain that shared leadership spirit after we made that initial agreement. And what we experienced in that 2 years was the best 2 years of my 18 in the House because we learned to share agendas. We learned to talk every week about what we wanted to put on a committee agenda or the House floor. And we learned to trust each other and work together well. And compromise was absolutely necessary. The math required it. And the interesting thing is that there would be survey research every couple of years on voter trust in the legislature. Our numbers were never higher in the 18 years. Mm-hmm. The public wanted that kind of cooperation. And so I think a lot about why not today? Social media, how we get our news, money in politics. Mm. But when all is said and done, a lot of this is determined in primaries with only 15 or 20% of the electorate turning out to vote.
I mean, we get the government that the public provides us. And I think the missing element is the higher level, a higher degree of engagement by citizens. Now, we have to take some responsibility for the disengagement, those of us who are in office, but the solution has to come from much more engaged electorate.
Why would someone want to run for elected office? What would you do? What would you say to someone who is on the other side of where you once stood, considering that run? Why would someone want to run?
Well, there are a lot of reasons not to, and it's easy. We don't have to list those, right? It's a way to expose your family to all sorts of criticism. It's a life that is sometimes difficult and it's frustrating. But the reason to do it, the reason I did it 42 years ago, is the same reason I do it now. It's an opportunity to try to do something to help people in your community, to do something to make it a better world, to create policy that, you know, that makes a difference in the lives of people who are less fortunate. And every chance we get to do that, we can do it in this war. Now, we can do it in lots of different roles. You could have done it as a pastor, as a teacher, in whatever role you thought you might land in. And in public service, you do it with a different set of tools at your behest. I've always said I've never changed business cards. I've only changed business cards. I've never changed jobs. It's always the same thing. You're just trying to do something to advance, you know, the people that you care about, advance their interests.
For those who are considering running for office, it's not only the chance to be a part of problem solving and to leave a state or a country better places, but it's an opportunity to work in a very diverse group of people who have a lot of different interests and much to learn from. I learned so much in my years in the legislature about issues that I hadn't even thought about from people with different perspectives. I learned how to problem solve with people of having different perspectives. And that was so fulfilling, and some of my best friendships today are people I never would have met or lived with in a community. You know, one of the tragedies today is we're so segregated by race, by income, and we don't have those opportunities. In a legislative body, you have it all.
Yeah.
Well, I know we have to let our congressman catch your favorite part of the job, right? Flying to and from D.C.
That's right.
Well, Congressman Dan Kildee and former Michigan House Speaker Paul Hillegans, thank you so very much for being generous enough to come in here and help me mark my final week with another Dream Dinner conversation.
Thank you for your service.
Ah, thank you.
Yes, you made a huge difference for a long time. And I'm sure in other ways you'll continue to.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Tomorrow on Stateside, I'll talk with the fine folks from the Michigan History Center. We'll look at some of the gems we've uncovered in our state's history through these years. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.